load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Welcome to the Wealth Money Radio Show, brought to you by WealthMoney.org. Byron Dale and Greg Soderbergh are your hosts. This is the only program that addresses the destructive consequences of using a debt money system. Financial slavery is the result when all money is created and put into circulation through loans. How interest grows the debt, but not the money supply, and the effects that interest and debt has on our lives. If you would like to join the program and have a question or a comment, please call 347-884-9499. That's 347-884-9499. And now your hosts, Byron Dale and Greg Soderbergh.
What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
You know, Tennessee probably didn't know it, but an evidence of our indebtedness is what we use for money. When the money was changed from debt-free to debt, we were made debt slaves. Good morning and welcome to Wealth Money Radio, June 29th, 2019. I'm Greg Soderbergh, and I'm here with Byron as usual, Byron Dale. Wealth Money Radio is about what we use for money, how it's created and put into circulation, how that affects our lives. It's also about proposed legislation called the American Transportation Act. I've made some changes to the wealthmoney.org homepage. Now you can click on the slider images to read our writings, like Roads and Bridges Without Taxing or Borrowing, and others like The Switch, which is our book explaining how the currency was changed as they corrupted the money, and pictures of the changes. You can click on The Switch, the American Transportation Act, any of the slides, read the material. You can print it off. You can save it. You can attach them to emails. So why don't you call in and be a part of the show this morning. The number again is 347-884-9499. So Byron, what's your favorite topic today?
Well, we're going to talk a little about the history of money, but before we do that, Rule's on, and we want to see if he has anything that he'd like to say before we get into the history of the money in the United States. Go ahead, Rule. Whoops. Well, now you can go ahead, Rule.
Yeah,
sorry.
A lot of thoughts this morning. Greg sent me a link last week on Minnesota dairy farmers and how well, you know, they are not doing. And I did a lot of pondering overnight and thought about the history of, and I don't want to turn this into a biblical radio show, of course, but, you know, all the Old Testament prophets and people were forewarned not to put God to the test and not to tempt God. And one of those areas was in the matter of how they treated one another and through usury. And it seems to me that, right, you know, the whole world, or especially through our banking system, Federal Reserve, is basically throwing a fist in the air towards God and said, no, we will not honor your debt-free, non-usury way of life. We are going to disobey and tempt you, and it's storing up wrath for destruction is the way I see it, if people believe that, you know, in a God or that the Bible is true. So,
well, I guess we won't know for sure until one day we probably find out the real hard way. And it's kind of the same thing, you know, you talk about the history of money, and that's what I wanted to get into. And I got into it partly because I was on Facebook, and this economist was, or he thought he was an economist at least, he always come in and, you know, he was, everything was so, you know, all about what money could do and never about actually how it was created. He had it created several different ways. And it got me thinking, and I was looking through some old writings that I've done, and I found one. And this is kind of what we're going to go through the show today, kind of some of this history. And the first thing we need to really understand is economics is not about what is own, is about what you can do with money. You know, all the different things that you can do and invest in, all these kind of things. It's not about the money itself. It's not about how money is created and put into circulation and the effect that has on people's lives. In all my 36 years of studying money, and I have really just done hours and hours and hours and hours of research, I have only run into one economist that truly understands how money is created and it put into circulation. And he was an economist from New York. And he, you know, he was a college professor, and we talked, and he said there was a group of them that talked together a lot. And I asked him, well, do you ever bring up this subject? And he says, I have sometimes since I talked to you the first time. And they looked at me and said, where did you ever hear anything like that? Which pretty much proved that, you know, they don't even consider money in well, how is it actually created and gets into circulation. It's just all the things we can do with it and things we can invest and things we can this and that and the other thing. And but that's not really what this show is all about. This show is about getting down to actually how it's money is, if I may use the word, born into circulation. And so it's there so we can use. And I really have truly found very few people that ever really tried to research that in any depth. And if you go back, and we'll kind of start back in 1694 first, and then we'll go back a little further when they get into it. But that's pretty much when England kind of took it over, and the bankers took it over. Because the king, he was always in wars, and he ran out of money. And I could never really understand that, because by the old laws, that the king owned all the gold and silver that was ever mined in any area that he had control over. Any area, every area. And not only that, he had the power to tax it back after he spent it. So if all of the gold and silver were mined in every country, and at that time they said that the sun never set on England, so it had a lot of worldwide control of colonies like they did in America. Well, if you could do that and then tax it back, and how would they run out of gold and silver? But they did. They run out of whatever they was using for money. And actually, I researched and researched, and I can never find any place where England had a single gold mine. Not a single one, ever. And so, you know, that would, they'd have to get it from some other country. But anyway, so then this banker come along and said, well, I can sure help you out here. If you'll let my note be the nation's money, you know, for a while they used wampum sticks or sticks, you know, where they cut a little notch in them and then they collected them back. And but he said, we can make this a lot better if we just go with, and I will create the money with my bank and we can provide you with all the money they wanted. And boy, they thought that was a good idea. So that's how it started. And then you also have to remember, most of our founding fathers, it was had to do with forming our constitution and our country and our government. Most of them was Englishmen. Not, maybe not all, but most. And so as we look back in there, in early United States history, money of any kind was so scarce that they didn't hardly have any. And the first that I've ever been able to find is in 1634, the Court of Massachusetts created the first law for money, you know, something that could be used as legal tender as money. And it ordered that musket balls of full bore, full size, was legal tender and had the same value as a farthing. Now, a farthing was a British bond coin worth a quarter of a penny, so it wasn't very much. And then they went on to that. Well, then later on in 1637, they declared wampum could be legal tender. Now, wampum was seashells and stuff like that that they would work out, and then they put it on a necklace. And that's they used that for their barter, for their money. And so for a while there, they made that legal tender in the United States. And then in the Virginia College, where they raised a lot of tobacco, tobacco was used for money. And in 1640, the Massachusetts colony began to do a lot of trading with other colonies and with the West Indian Islands. Many different coins began to enter the Massachusetts colony. The most prominent of these coins were Spanish mill coins. And some of them were coins, and some were not really coins. They were just lumps of silver with a standard shape. And I have, if you go into wealthmoney.org, you can probably find some of this writing. If not, if you get my book, The Secrets of Modern Money, they're all there with pictures and everything. And so these things were actually what they did when they found a lot of silver down in South America. And so Spanish was shipping that back to Spain. And a lot of that was just done for inventory purposes to get it ready to ship. And I'm sure, you know, the English had a lot of pirates out there stealing stuff, and so that's how some of it probably came in the United States too. And regardless of how they looked at it, it was just really a short amount of money. The Massachusetts Mint was the first and most successful and largest running of all the colonial mints. The demand for the exportation of the coins drained the supply of silver to where they had to shut down because they didn't have any silver to keep the mint open. They had to close it down. It goes to show you that, you know, and again, you got to understand that at the time of this area, there was not a gold or silver mine in the United States. Anybody knew of later after the Constitution, several years, they discovered gold down in North Carolina, I think it was. But so they started with all kinds of things, and the history of paper currency is quite interesting. It starts with colonial days and continues up till today. And history reveals the first U.S. currency can be traced back to 1690. It was produced by Massachusetts Bay Colony paper currency and was soon introduced to other states as well. And I can't show you that, but I have a picture of that that shows it. And it was probably a very elusive little job for all those who were printing money. And from 1730 on, Franklin was the printer of all the currency issued by Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And so he was doing all the printing, and then he would sell it to them. And it probably cost him more to do that than it did when he printed all for the votes and laws of the colony assembled. And then the war broke out, and it took an enormous amount of funds to fight a war, which we all know. The Continental Congress didn't have any authority to tax, and if they would have had the authority to tax, the people wouldn't have any money to pay the tax because the money was really short. The Continental Congress issued paper currency, which was widely known as the Continental Currency. Now, I've had held some of that in my hand, and it clearly said that it was be redeemable in Spanish mill coins or a way to gold and silver. And if they just did that the correct way, but again, I don't think they understood hardly anything about actually how money should be created for the benefit of the people. They did not issue that money. It was issued as an IOU, payable in Spanish mill coins or the equivalent gold and silver. And then the currency lost its value. And again, if you go back here, let's get back a little bit here. Because when I was first reading this, I was told that this currency, the continental currency, lost its value and purchasing power because they had just printed too much of it. But as I went on and studied more, I found out that wasn't the truth at all. The currency lost its value because it was widely counterfeited by the British. and because it was a promise to pay Spanish coins, and, you know, they didn't have and had no way of getting them, because that was the problem. If they'd have had them, then they would have just used them. They wouldn't have had to figure out notes promised to pay them. And, of course, they did that, and I have in the book, Modern Money Secrets, the actual ad that was put in New York, where you could go in there and you could buy all the continental currency you wanted for the cost of paper. And they said, we guarantee you it'll work because we had done it a lot in its past, because nobody knows the difference. And so we have no idea how much money that was actually counterfeited and put into circulation. And, of course, what really happened, we go on here a little bit more. When the current Constitution was adopted, one of the first things the new Congress did under the guidance of Hamilton was establish a central bank that issued paper currency. It is clear that paper currency was needed to run the business transaction because there wasn't any gold and silver around to actually do it. Banks were granted permission to issue currency notes. And then I have a picture here of one of the first notes issued by the United States Bank. When Thomas Jefferson became president, he did not renew the charter for the first United States Bank, and expired in 1811. In 1810, it was estimated the money in the circulating United States was around $50 million. It was also estimated there was not even $10 million in gold and silver money in the entire country. So you can see how, you know, if it was a promise to pay those things, it couldn't possibly pay it because there wasn't that much in the first place. So it goes on, and all paper notes were just banks' promises to pay, which they would not, could not, and would not pay. On top of that, the people had to borrow the banks' promise to obtain any spendable money. And, you know, if you look into this long enough, you will find out that a lot of people have said, man, if you just keep telling the lie over and over and over again, people will believe it. And that's what they've done in this whole country, is to keep telling us lies, especially about money and politics, and keep telling us all about the, you know, what's good and what's bad and things like that, and how much money there is and how much debt they got. But then you'll get people like MMMT come along, and they said, well, actually the government creates the money. And in a sense, that is right, in a sense, because the government, you know, the Treasury in the Constitution, the power to coin money was given to the Congress. And they go ahead and they did that, and they established the Bureau of the Mint, the mint coins, and they established the Bureau of Printing to print currency. But then it took a nasty turn because after they printed the coins or minted the coins, they didn't just spend them. They sold them and issued them to the banks, and then you have to go to the bank to get the coins. And now I'm going to stop a minute, and I want Greg to tell his personal story about the letter he got from the Treasury that says, well, we can't give you, we can print the currency, but we can't give it to you. You got to go to the banks to get it. And now I want you to tell your experience about that, Greg.
Okay. So, you know, back when I got started with this in about 1990, I was writing a lot of questions to the Treasury and Fed Reserve banks and stuff. And it got into some things about coinage anyway, I wrote them and I said, I asked them if they'd send me some dollars, you know, some Federal Reserve notes, and they wrote me back and said that they weren't available for direct delivery to the public. You know, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing prints them up, but they're not available for direct delivery to the public. And that way, it also means that our government doesn't print them up and spend them into circulation. It doesn't happen that way. They said, you can only get them from your local lending institution. So I went down to my bank where I had a checking account and savings account, and went to the first clerk, and I said, Chester, she could help me. And I said, yeah. I said, I was wondering if you had Federal Reserve notes. And she didn't know what I was talking about. And fortunately, a friend of mine who also worked there at the next teller window overheard the conversation, and she come over and she said, I'll take care of this. And he says, Greg, what did you want? You know? And I said, well, I got this letter from the Treasury that says the only place I can get Federal Reserve notes is here at my local lending institution. And I said, so I was wondering if you had some. And she said, oh yeah, we got some, but we can't give them to you. And but I said, that's the Treasury said this is where I got to get them. And she said, well, yeah, you get them here, but we don't give them to you. You got to buy them. And so I said, well, what do I buy them with? Because I can't give you Federal Reserve notes for Federal Reserve notes. And I mean, that doesn't work. She said, well, you gotta pay for them with a check for cash written against your checking account. So if you want a $10 Federal Reserve note or $10 in various denominations adding up to $10, you have to write a check for cash for $10 against the numbers in your checking account. And so that's how you get them. And the interesting thing about the whole thing is you can even ask yourself, well, how do all them numbers get in the checking account in the first place? And, of course, the answer to that question is that all the numbers in your checking account are created when a bank makes a loan to someone. It may not be to you, but it's to someone. And so, you know, here you go. You know, you're just buying them Federal Reserve notes with other obligations. And that's what John B. Henderson at the Congressional Research Office told me in a white paper, is that now we have, when you get a loan and you have numbers in your checking account, now you have money, so to speak, that you can use to pay other obligations. Well, think about that. The money got into your checking account when you got the loan. Now you were obligated. Now you had a debt in your checking account that you can use for money, and you're supposed to be able to pay other debts with that debt. And that's where we're at today, is this whole debtonomy that we live in is expecting us to pay debt with debt and get rid of the debt. And that's what Byron and I are trying to, one of the points we're trying to make is that it's impossible. And that's why the debt keeps growing and growing. And we have the spiritual, moral, ethical, legal, and social problems that we do. So did that answer your question, Byron?
Yeah, that's what I wanted you to explain. And then I want to go and talk in, you know, because when I was first getting into this and researching and studying all the time, and at that time we had a ranch, and I got really interested because I saw things were wrong, so I was trying to kind of think some of this stuff through and research it. And one day I was out in the shop, and we was getting ready to go to work, and I was talking to my oldest son who just graduated from high school, and I asked him a few questions about if he'd ever learned anything about money in high school, and he said, no, and I'm not really interested. We've got a lot of stuff to do. I mean, we, you know, we had a 5,000-acre ranch and a lot of hay to put up and all kinds of things. And, but he said, Dad, I can see you're really into this. You really want to know. So I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. And I'll run this ranch for 3 months, and then I'm going to go to college. You've got 3 months that you just can go do whatever you want to do, try to figure out what you're trying to find out, and just leave me alone. Don't ask me any more questions, and that's what I'll do. And I said, are you really serious? And he said, absolutely. And I said, well, son, you just made yourself a deal. So he went to work, and I went in the office, or in the house, and I had a small office there, and I started researching, and in that process, I got a letter that somebody sent to the Treasury, and they said that it cost a penny to get a bill printed, a note printed, you know, a Federal Reserve note printed. And so I thought that was kind of interesting, so I wrote the Treasury a letter, and I said, Dear Sirs, please find enclosed a $1 bill or 100 cents. With this, I wish to purchase 100 $100 bills. I understand this is the price you charge the Federal Reserve Banks to print them for their use, And I must remind it, if you don't honor this and continue to sell only to the Federal Reserve Bank, then I will seek legal action for violation of antitrust laws. And so I sent him the dollar, and I got a letter back from the Treasury, and it said, "Dear Mr. Dale, this is in response to your letter of November 15, 1982, in purchase of 100 $100 bills. The Bureau of Imprinting and Engraving and Printing produces the nation's currency and sells it to the Federal Reserve Banks for $20.60 per thousand notes." Now that's 2.6 cents. "The notes, however, are not money until they are monetized and issued by a Federal Reserve Bank." So I wrote them and asked them, well, how in the world do they monetize them? Do they shake holy water on them, or just what do? To turn the written note into money? Because I guarantee you, if you'd have been there at the back door, and I have been to Washington, the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, I've watched them print it, and they go through it, and then they set them on a pallet, and the truck comes in and hauls them away. Well, I guarantee you, if you'd robbed that truck about two blocks away from there, I guarantee you that'd all be spendable money. But see, the Treasury said, well, they weren't, that you had to be monetized, but issued by the Federal Reserve. Okay, to obtain notes, a Federal Reserve Bank must pledge collateral equal to the face value of the note. Collateral must consist in the following assets, a loan or in any combination: 1, gold certificate; 2, special drawing rights; 3, United States government securities, you know, that's bonds and things, and eligible paper is described by statute. And then it went on, Federal Reserve notes are obligations to the United States, and the United States has a first lien on the assets of the issuing Federal Reserve Bank. Money without banking is backing without is worthless, and in effect you are suggesting that currency be printed without the necessary collateral, which is required of the Federal Reserve Bank. And, you know, it's a strange thing because they order them up, and then they buy bonds with them, and then they put up the bonds as collateral so they can get the Federal Reserve notes for, you know, very little. And so this eligible paper, I got kind of interested in that, and I started studying that a lot, and I found out that the law said that any rancher, farmer, or certain other people could issue notes, and that would be could be used as the collateral they talked about here, so you have Federal Reserve notes issued. So I did a lot of research on that. We won't get into that a lot right now. So you can see how that works. So then after I got that back, I wrote him another letter, and I said, please find enclosed $412 plus $2 million in collateral. Please send me $20,100 bills. I understand this is what is required by the Federal Reserve Banks to print them for their use. So they wrote back and said, "This your personal check for $20, your personal check number 20 for $412 is hereby returned. The Bureau of Engraving Printing is not authorized to issue or print United States paper currency for direct delivery to the public. Currency notes are placed into circulation by your local financial organization and can only be obtained by that source." And you just heard exactly that's what Greg did. So he said, well, I'll go down and get some, because and he found out that, wait a minute, you gotta have them borrow money from the bank and get those numbers into your account. Then you can use those numbers to buy the Federal Reserve notes, and then they'll take the numbers out of your bank, and they go away, and Federal Reserve notes come out of the bank in your hand, and basically now they say they go into circulation. And so now actual Federal Reserve notes went into circulation, and some of the numbers went out of your checking account. And then as you go through things, I kept studying and finding little things in here. And one of the things I found really interesting is how all the money changed. And I found quite an article about one time somebody in the federal government wanted to start using more gold and silver for money, and of course they didn't have any much. So any gold or silver that came from some other country, when they got there, the law said that you had to take it to this certain area and turn it in, and then if it was gold, they'd give you a gold certificate. And I have a picture of one here, of course you can't see, but it says right on it, it's a gold note. It isn't a note. This certifies there is been on deposit in the treasury this much gold and this much silver. Same thing with the silver certificate. So see, now that you had paper money that represented how much actual gold and silver that was put into a vault someplace in the United States, then they melted that down and then they used it however they wanted to use it. So these things went on, and then I kept studying, and I found out that in the, just give me a second here. I covered up my magnifying glass here so I could see better. And the Federal Reserve note, United States of America, redeemable in gold on demand at the United States Treasury or in gold or lawful money at any Federal Reserve Bank. And it says we'll pay to the bearer on demand $10. And it also has, it's a series 1926 or 8, I can't tell for sure. Then down below it, they changed it. And now it's a Federal Reserve note, United States of America. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and redeemable in lawful money at the United States Treasury or at any Federal Reserve Bank. But they didn't ever say what lawful money was. This clearly wasn't the lawful money because it says right in this face, it is redeemable in lawful money.
Yep.
But I have yet to this day ever figured out what that lawful money was, unless they've been talking about maybe gold and silver currency, you know, because then see that wasn't actually a debt. That was stating that this certifies that this gold and silver is on somebody's vault someplace and you can get it if you want it. And, of course, most people never wanted it because it was so much more convenient to use the paper notes. Okay, now down the line here, there's a third one, Federal Reserve note, United States of America. Oh, that other date was 1934. And then the other one now in 1950, it says, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Same thing as the other one, only now the first one was four lines and bigger print. Now this is three lines and smaller print, and it still says we'll pay to the bearer on demand $10. Okay, then in 1981... the notes come out, and it says, Federal Reserve note, United States of America. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. But there's nothing about ever payable in gold or silver, you know. It didn't say a thing about that. That's all been dropped. Well, to be a legal note, you have to have a promise to pay written on its face. That's what the law says. But you can see, it's pretty clear here, the Federal Reserve don't pay any attention to the law. They just do what they want to do. And you can see how the currency has even been changed. Well, then, everybody, you hear it all the time about how Lincoln was so great because he put in United States notes in 1863, I think. And they went into circulation, and the government printed this note, and then they spent it into circulation to buy things to have, you know, that they needed to have fund the war. But they hardly ever tell, and I wouldn't have known this, except that the one time I used to get monthly papers from the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis, and in it told me all about how that Lincoln, I think just a few months later after he did that, he reestablished that the Federal Reserve banks could be in federal jurisdiction, not just state. And I need to back up here a little because after Jefferson got rid of them, then the War of 18, whatever it was, had come along, 14 or something, and they needed a lot more money. So, again, what they did was they went back and started letting the banks print the money. Well, that went on until Jackson got into governor and president, and after that he decided, well, they were a bunch of crooks, which they really are, And so he would not renew their charter either, so they went out of business. And then, of course, State Bank popped up every place. And they got just as far out of the country as they could get most of the time because, again, them notes said they would give them gold and silver, and, of course, none of them had it. I've found out that there was only about 18% of the total amount of gold for $100 worth of the notes they put out. So we know that was impossible. Well, then when in 1863, then Jackson said again, no, pardon me, Lincoln said, well, we'll let the state banks now become federal banks and they can act at the federal level. Well, as soon as they got that power, then they started trying to shut down all the state banks and they put a tax on them. So they had to pay a tax. And back at that time, all the banks was actually printing up this currency, each bank. And I've been in Washington, D.C., and they have a place there where you can go through all a list of all them banks, state banks, and all the notes, and, I mean, just a lot of them. And I don't have a copy of all them, but I have seen them and held them in my hand. Then one day some bright young college, I don't know how young or old, I never could find out who it was that did it, but they decided, well, wait a minute, we can get around this tax. We don't need to print this currency. All we got to do is just put the numbers in their checking account. Instead of giving them the notes, let's just put the money into the checking account and numbers. And that's what now that's where how we got started checkbook money. That's where how that got started, and that's where it came from. And, of course, then that's what now most all of them do is just create the money and put the money in the checking account. You know, when you borrow the money, they then, as a banker told me and explained to me how it worked, that when I go to borrow, I will get the loan. Then I'll have to sign a promissory note, mortgage, and probably maybe a mortgage too, depending on how big a deal it is. Then that will go on the books as an asset to the bank and a liability to the borrower. Okay, and then the bank will put those numbers into their checking account as a liability to them. In other words, all they do is write into your checking account how much they owe you. And then that becomes money all of a sudden. And we all think it is, and we all use it as that. But, of course, it's not really even by law legal tender or anything. And so then, they all add interest on it. And, of course, the interest always makes the debt grow. So, and one time, I used to make a lot of noise, and I had made a lot of press, and so they sent some people out there to build me up and kill me, and I have a letter from a guy, a couple of brothers, that talked to the governor after he was no longer governor, and the subject of money came up, and he got mad as heck and said, that son of a so-and-so up north wouldn't shut up, so I've met some people up to take him out. And anyway, and they beat me up pretty bad, and they were still trying to foreclose and take everything I had because I had issued one of these notes that they said was legal tender, and it could be used to get Federal Reserve notes as collateral. Everything I'd done was what they'd already told me it would work and would get done. And so we was in the courtroom, and so then they put me on the witness stand, and they started then saying, "Why you don't believe in the Federal Reserve note, you don't believe in this and that." And I said, "No, it's all there. My problem is it's not a workable system." "Well, what do you mean?" So I said, "Well, if you'd let me have my stuff, I'd show you." So we did. He got it. So I said, "Okay, now here's just what it says. And you guys all agree the banks create money," and they all, seven lawyers in the room, all agreed. And so then, okay, now I'll be the banker and you'll be the borrower. So I loaned him a dollar and I said, "Now you owe me a dollar. And of course, you have to put up collateral. That's the way it works, isn't it?" And all seven lawyers agreed. And so, okay, so he said, "Well, I'll give you my pen for collateral." I said, "That's fine." And now the bank charge interest. So I get to charge interest, and they all agreed. So I said, "Well, interest is 10%. That'd be fair, wouldn't it?" And, of course, at that time, interest was between 18% and 22%. So they thought that was a pretty good deal. And they all agreed. And so I said, "Okay, now there had to be a first one at some time." And they all agreed. They said, "Okay, that was the first one. So I've decided not to give you any more or not to have any more. So now would you please pay me the $1.10 you owe me? And he looked at me kind of funny, and he looked at his hand, and he looked at the $1 bill, and then he looked at me, and then he reached in his pocket and took out the pencil and put it on the dollar and gave it to me. And I turned to the bankruptcy judge, and I said, sure didn't take long to get his property, did it? That's what the whole thing is about. And, oh, that judge just went out of his head mad. He just went on and said, well, I should show you out and let him take you, and I should put you in bankruptcy right now and just take everything, but I'm not legally supposed to do that because you're a rancher or a farmer, so we'll just dismiss it. And at the same time, at the same hearing, they had come out and taken all my hay, and they put it out on at the sale barn. And they put it in the rodeo grounds. And so then it come along late enough in the spring, and they wanted to have rodeos. And so they said, well, man, we got to get rid of that hay. We got to get moved. So they went to the sale barn land that was close there and said, we'll sell that hay real cheap, but you've got to agree to backdate your check, because now he's in bankruptcy. He cannot do anything like that. We can't sell any of the property or anything, and we got to get it moved. So he agreed that he would do that. And then he come and told me about it, and he said, I'd like to go to the bankruptcy court and, you know, testify to all this. So we agreed, and he came, and I had a lawyer there from North Dakota, and that was supposed to be representing me, and he refused to let him go on the witness stand and tell the truth of whatever the banking system was that I was working with, what they had done, and it was absolutely illegal and a violation of the bankruptcy laws and stuff, and he refused to do it. So you can see how tight all these guys are working together. The courts and everybody, they have no interest in what's good for the people, only what's good for the banking system. And this is personal research and personal experience that I've had that people need to start thinking about instead of listening to these economists and people like MMT that are filling them full of nonsense, the same old thing. If I tell a lie big enough, everybody will believe it. But if you tell them the truth, oh, I don't believe that. I don't think they would do that. So it's an amazing thing we live in. And with that, I'll turn it back to Greg and Rule and whoever else might have wanting to say something. Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I don't know. I always get back to the fact that it all boils down to that right now somebody has to be in debt for money to exist. And in a land where we're supposed to have liberty and justice for all, I don't see how we can have justice for all when one of us has to be in debt for money to exist. And, like Byron was talking about, when the guy decided instead of lending out the physical notes, they would just put numbers in checking accounts and create the checking accounts. And so, if they can create the numbers and lend them, which obviously they do, the numbers can be created and spent into circulation. And that's what we propose, is that the Treasury simply create the numbers. And the way that, and see, this is the other thing too, is I don't think a lot of these folks have any idea of how you could spend money into circulation and make it work. I just don't think anybody except the Wealth Money Group has thought about that at all. But if you look at the Constitution, one of the intents in the preamble was to promote the general welfare. The other thing, Congress was to coin money or create money, and they were to provide post offices and post roads. So Byron once upon a time came up with the idea that, hey, why don't the Treasury simply create the numbers and spend them into circulation to build our roads and bridges so we can have commerce and do all the things that we do with these roads and bridges, and do it in lieu of taxation or bonding. And then the money would go into circulation with the increase in production.
Greg, can I interrupt here just a second?
Yeah.
Because you brought up something that I wanted to talk about was because, you know, how I got that idea. My sister-in-law worked in a bank for years and years. And one day a woman come up to the bank and she wanted to deposit this little note from California. Good, California was out of money and they was issuing notes. And she said, well, I don't have a clue what this is or what to do with it. I'll have to go talk to somebody. And so she went and talked to the president of the bank, and he says, oh, there's one of them California notes. Just put it in the bank as a non-cash asset and give her the money. And that's when I got the idea, well, wait a minute. If California can do that, why can't other people do that? And so I started going down. We had, and Greg and I had went to, down to Washington a lot of times trying to get these people down there to think about it. And they didn't have a clue. And most of them wasn't even interested. And some of them was listening, some of them wasn't. And they just had so stooped in their stupidity that they just can't see the truth and see the object. And so that's when I got started. And then I started, well, it was a lot easier to go down to the state capitol than it was the federal capitol, because to go down there from Minneapolis, you got to drive for 2 days and stay in a hotel. And then we did. We'd do that, and then we'd have a meeting with a legislator every hour on the hour for 5 days. And then, of course, you got to drive back and all that expense, where it only takes me about 25 minutes to get down to the Capitol from where my house here in the Edina. So I started working on them. And there were two people that got interested, and we got it introduced. But the people just couldn't see it. One legislator, he got all excited, and he said, oh, my God, don't even talk about it. It's a thing. Our whole money is based on belief so if you destroyed that, well, the whole money system would go bad. But they never would stop to think. And one time, the first time I really explained it to the whole group, one guy sat in the back and he said, wow, that's terrible. That just like the Wright brothers. And I said, well, yeah, but everybody, they threw the Wright brothers out of their church and everything else. But by golly, they did fly that plane. And I said, and look at all the benefit we've got from that. Look at now what they can do with planes and all this that they could, when everybody said, well, that would be impossible. And now it'd be the same thing if we would do this with the money. And of course, you just can't let them create all the money. You could, because that's what the banks do. They create all the money that anybody wants. If you can give them a story that they can believe that you might be able to pay it back, they'll loan you the money. It don't make a difference what it is. I see in Minneapolis now, most of the stores we go to, especially the big ones, are all remodeling. It costs billions of dollars. And I know that those stores don't have that much cash to pay that, so they've got to borrow the money. But then there must be some sort of a tax deal that they can get, because so they don't have to, you know, so they can get this all back through lack of taxes. So it's again the same old thing, you know, instead of sitting down and actually thinking about it. Well, but if you follow the Constitution and just have the money created for something that benefits everybody, instead of like what the Democrats would want to do now, where they would want to spend the money so everybody could have health care and everybody could have free college and everybody could have everything. But all they can think about is just raising taxes, and that's exactly all the Minnesota legislature is thinking about. Well, we can't do anything different. We just have to raise the taxes someplace, somehow. We got to raise more taxes. And it seems like that they don't seem to understand that there's only a limit of how much taxes the average people can pay and still say above a board, you know. It's amazing how hard it is to get people to actually stop and think of something that's logical and will work. Go ahead.
Well, the other thing they don't think about, Byron, is we have to borrow that money before they can even tax us. You know,
that's right. Absolutely.
They don't. And the other thing, you know, where that one guy says, and a lot of them said, our money is based on faith or belief. I've never had anybody explain to me what that faith and belief is. You know, and if it's faith and belief, then why do I have to be in debt for it? I mean, You know, it's just these stupid things.
And not only that, you know, you got these kitties, the cities like L.A. in California. I mean, it's just my son lives there, and my wife was talking to him here a while back, and we saw on TV on how all every place now they're just all these people are living in tents out there. You know, they don't have any money. They don't give a rip. They do their bathroom things right in the streets and everything else, and nobody, I mean, it just goes on and on. They don't do nothing about it. And she sent something about that to my son who lives there, and he says, oh, Mom, it's a lot worse than that. It's everywhere. Well, now, and in that, they don't want to ever stop the immigration from coming. They can just come and come. Well, they walk in from I don't know where, and they don't have anything. And where are all them people going to get jobs? And most of them can't even speak English. And how can it be? I work with people that really do a good job, but if they have to read something, you have to read it to them and explain it to them because they can't read yet. And they're from another country and been here a long time. And, of course, some people are more intelligent in that direction and others are more intelligent in other directions, but it takes a while to do that. And how in the world do they think they can keep bringing all them people in and not have these kind of problems? And they don't seem to have any solutions except, well, the government could give you everything free, but not a single one of them talks about where the money's going to come from. And, yes, you could create all that money for those things, but, see, it wouldn't be beneficial to the whole country. It would just cause more people sitting around doing nothing. But if you do it the other way, now you put money into every community every year because all the communities need to rebuild their roads and resurface their roads and stuff like this. And if the population gets bigger, probably build more roads. And that money then would be put into circulation based upon actual work and production that people do and then spent into circulation in every part of the country for the benefit of everyone. Because the people who actually do it would get the money and spend it, and then it'd be just like when you borrow money and spend it, that money goes into circulation and starts moving around. In fact, one guy on Facebook, he said, well, if you just had enough money, if you just had money and moved it fast enough, you wouldn't need to borrow any money. And you know, you can't move it until you borrow it. But see, again, he's got his mind all screwed up with the difference between economics and with the difference of actually talking about how the money is really created and put into circulation. Go ahead, Greg.
Well, there's all kinds of things I think about when we have this show, but I didn't want to forget about rules. Wondering if he's there and if he had anything he wanted to say.
I don't think he is, no.
Okay.
I don't see his thing here now.
Yeah, and so, you know, I don't know. It's just, you know, there's so many other things, too. If you create this money and spend it in for these roads and bridges, it isn't just a matter, it wouldn't be just a matter anymore of tar and cement, you know. You could build water drainage systems into these roads and clean that water before it went back into the water table. You build solar into these roads. Your rest stops could have electric charging stations. If somebody had an electric car, they could drive in and charge the car for free. Because, you know, once the systems are built and paid for, you don't get a bill from the sun every month. That energy is just there. And, of course, we haven't advanced far enough in these areas yet because we haven't had the money to do it. But if you just follow the concept of the computer, remember the first computers, how big they were and how little they did, and now how small they are and how much they do. And this is what happens when you can deal with solar.
Well, Greg, if you think about that too, you need to think about your hand, you know, calculator, you know. I remember the first one I got. My gosh, it was a big thing. And now they're just like a little slip, you know, that you just punch in the things. And now you got them in your computer that has unlimited numbers. You know, before you only could go so many numbers high, and that was it. And I got my first one when I was farming them because when you go in those days, when you went to the sale, they run the cattle in, they sold them, and then they weighed them and they got out. Well, you know, a lot of that is knowing whether or not how much you're really paying is you got to be able to guess their weight and be right. Because in those days, lighter ones would bring a lot more dollars per pound than the heavier ones. Well, but see, if he weighs a lot heavier than you think he does, and then you pay a whole lot more money, you find out, man, you made a really bad buy. And so it helped me due to that, because then you can see and have to do all that, you know, in your mind or on pen, where you just had to punch the computer, you know, the calculator right quick, and you had just exactly what they weighed, and pretty quick you got really good at that, where you pretty well knew. And all these things, you know, if we do things like we're talking about for the benefit of the people, for the benefit of everybody, and to put that money into circulation without debt and without interest, and now interest is about 60% of the price of everything, so you can imagine prices go down about 60% as soon as you got rid of the interest. And I haven't found it yet, but I've got it that clearly says from the Treasury how easy that would be, because if they got rid of the Federal Reserve System, all the assets of the Fed would go to the government. So now all the government debts would just go away, because now it's an asset of the Fed, but that would mean it was an asset of the thing, so it's impossible really to owe yourself anything. I mean, you can't say, well, my right pocket owes $10 to the left pocket. I mean, it really is nonsense. And, of course, see, this is what this whole thing is about, a lot of nonsense, instead of just stopping and thinking about what would be the real beneficial way to do it for everyone. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so, you know, this guy I was talking about, you just have to go spend the money faster and move the money faster and faster. Well, with a wealth money system based on concepts in the American Transportation Act, actually you'd have a more slowing down, a more casual lifestyle, less stress, and you'd have more time to do things. And when we start spending money to build these roads and bridges, you got to remember, it's not just the people going out there and installing the stuff. It's also jobs being created to manufacture the parts and the people to service the systems after they're put in. When the money starts coming into circulation and no debt, and you have to provide, and the American Transportation does, provide for a way to slowly stop the creation of money as debt. You just can't flip the switch overnight, okay? But with less and less debt being in your costs of living, you'd take more money home in your paycheck, because more people would be able to work and take care of themselves, and you wouldn't need the taxes taken out of your check for the social programs to help all these people. So you'd actually take home more money every week without earning any more money, totally. Your money would have...
And not only that, these businesses wouldn't always be looking for a way to cut their costs. See, this is why they want to have robots and stuff, because they don't want to have to pay... I've seen it in writing. The best way to enhance the profit in your business is to cut your labor costs. Cut your labor costs. But see, they never stop to think that once you cut the labor costs, then the labor has less money to buy the products. So they're actually killing themselves, or, you know, hitting themselves in the in the wherever. It's total nonsense, because they won't think about the long picture. Or if you did it the other way, first place, prices would go down 60% because the interest would be gone. So now you could have paid more people a lot more money, and you wouldn't have, and then you got to stop all these big people. Once they get the head of corporations, all of a sudden they realize that we can now set our own wages, and some of the wages go up 1,000 times more than what they're paying the actual people that's doing all the work. And it's the people that's doing all the work that needs more money so they can actually have a standard of living. Them big guys don't need 1,000 times that. You know, they don't need $60 million or $6 million of salary when the guy on the bottom gets, if he's lucky, if he gets $25,000 a year for payment. And it's, you know, when you get in to have some morals in the system, and that's, of course, what the Democratic Party has tried to do, is get rid of all the morals everywhere. And, you know, everything should be free. And
well,
that isn't the way. It can't possibly work that way. Because I don't know if you need to work, you know, quite a 40-hour week. But, you know, people have to have, I guarantee you, the easier money comes, the less you have, the less it means to you. And if you work for it, then it means something, and you pay attention to how you spend it, and you buy the good things and not just everything you see. And, you know, it's those things that somehow we've got to keep think about, and this all has to do with how money's put into circulation and the benefit everybody gets, not the BS everybody gets. Go ahead.
Yeah, not just for the special interests. But the other thing is, over time with a wealth money system, you know, you would have your cost of living would go down, your earned take-home income would actually go up, you'd have more personal savings, you'd probably have a more casual life. You might not have to work 40 hours a week. Maybe you work 30 hours a week and do something else you think is worthwhile, also worthwhile with your time. But it would create just a whole better society, and we'd actually be able to focus on real things, that problems that really need to be solved, instead of simply producing, buying, and selling. The other thing is, those people that want the government or think the government can do things for free education, free healthcare, free this, free that, it's kind of interesting that they would even use the word free along with government, because I don't see how a government can pay for things, give it to the people free, and be in debt up to its butt. How can the government provide it free when
it's
in debt?
I know, Greg. They're in debt clear up to their eyeballs is where they're in debt to.
Yeah. Well, it's way over their eyeballs.
But probably, you know, true. When you actually look at the total debt and the total money supply, and then you go look at all the people that have financial trouble and the amount of bankruptcies and all these kind of things, and it all comes from the same thing. When you give a certain small group of people the power to control everything, because they control 100% of the money, who it goes to and who can get it and who don't, and it can't be paid in the long run. It just has to grow and grow. And, you know, they have to have inflation, because if they didn't, I mean, man, years ago, you know, could buy a car for a couple of thousand. Now it's 20, 30, 40 to 50 thousand, and you know, and the cars are fancier. They got more gings and things in it, but they don't really run any better. And yes, I think a lot of them things are important. I personally like the concept when you have when a car gets in the blind spot, you know, the light comes on in your rearview mirror, so you know that somebody's going to be on there in your road if you can't turn over, which is really helps. I think it's a really beneficial thing, and they can do those things, but they wouldn't have to raise the prices. I mean, it's unbelievable some of the nonsense that goes on, because the head guys can get as much profit they want because they can set their wages, and they're not going to give the other people very much at all because they don't count.
Well, I like to think about comparing the money system we have today. Let's say that dentistry worked the way our money system did. And every time you went to the dentist and you had a cavity filled, you'd get more cavities. So you go back and get those 5 cavities fixed, and now you got 20 cavities. And that's the way this money system works, because you have constant and growing debt. Only way to get more money created is somebody has to go in debt and borrow it. And when they borrow it, now they're in servitude, obligation to some person who had nothing except the ability to create some numbers and put them in your account. And now that debt grows with time, but it don't make your loan principal increase. And so now you got to go out and try to get somebody else's loan principal. And so, you know, If you think that's liberty? Do you think it's justice for all? Do you think it's equality? Do you think it's promoting the general welfare? Well, the answer to all those questions is no. It's just the opposite. It's all about special interests. Yep. And it's all about inequality. And it's about who can get on top and control everything. It has nothing to do with our Constitution or constitutional boundaries. It's just about tyranny.
Or any moral principles.
Well, ethical, legal. I mean, I used to have an acronym for it. I called it SMELS, SMELS. Spiritual, moral, ethical, legal, and social. It affects all those things. And you can see it in society today. And you know, we were talking about before the show, boundaries. It's like children, whether they like it or not, children need to know what the boundaries are because it gives them some direction. It gives them
a thing of security. It really does.
Right.
And they feel more important and they feel safe.
And if those kids don't get taught those boundaries and taught to stay within those boundaries, then they grow up to be the kind of adults that we see a lot of today. They don't want any boundaries. They want to do what they want to do. And that, you know, then where does it end? It doesn't end. It just a limitless whatever anybody wants to do anytime, and they can justify it somehow by rationalizing it. And, you know,
and then in time it'll all blow up just like it always does and have to start over when, if we use some common sense, that would never have to happen. Well, I see it that time of day and I hear the bells is ringing. So again, I want to thank the listeners, and I also want to get people to stop and think if they want to really study some more of this and see the actual research, they can go to wealthmoney.org. And there's also Byron Dale's YouTube channel that they can go in and see and get a little bit more of this. And they've really got to start thinking about the fact that economics is not the same as trying to understand how the money is created and the benefits or the consequences of that.
And I would just like to say, Byron was talking about how they changed the money today. So you can go to wealthmoney.org, and on the right side of the homepage is a slide thing. And you click on that, and you'll see a book cover called The Switch. And if you click on that, you'll be able to read the book. You'll be able to see the notes and how they changed the wording on the notes and the explanation for all that. And not only can you read it, but you can save it as a file, and you can email it in attachments to people, or you can print it off also. So if you want to understand a little more about how they change the currency, just go to wealthmoney.org and click on The Switch, and that'll get you there.
To thank you for listening to the Wealth Money Radio Show. Please visit our website at wealthmoney.org. We would appreciate your support by purchasing the books and materials. Don't just purchase the books, but study the information we have presented and tell others the truth of our debt-based system, the problems interest causes, and the slavery it promotes. Thank you for your support.